remainings of the Ukrainian army and large group of civilians are basically encircled by the Russian forces. They continue their struggle, but it seems from the way Russian army behaves in Mariupol, they decided to raise the city to the ground at any cost.
That's the foreign minister of Ukraine, Dmytro Kuleba, speaking Sunday on CBS's Face of the Nation. Kuleba was responding to the situation in Mariupol, a city along the Black Sea that has been under siege for almost 2 months now and appears to be on the brink of falling to the Russians. Still, Ukrainian forces there have refused to surrender. They have blown past a deadline the Russian official set yesterday to concede. Local officials say more than 100,000 civilians are trapped in the city. Meanwhile, the western city of Lviv, which had been relatively untouched since the beginning of the war, saw its first known deaths today. It was one of hundreds of targets across Ukraine that Russia claimed to have hit today as it prepares to refocus its war efforts in the east. Here to talk about this is Alyssa Demus, international defense researcher at the RAND Corporation. Hi.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in Mariupol with the Russian forces basically surrounding the city and bombing it to smithereens. What is your understanding of the situation there and how much longer Ukrainian forces can hold out?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a pretty horrific situation. We know at least from what Ukrainian officials are telling us that it seems like the Ukrainian forces there are surrounded, encircled by Russian forces. It doesn't seem like they are at this point willing to surrender. As you mentioned, they've blown past the deadline set by Russia. You know, it's unclear how much longer they can sort of hold out. At least numerically speaking, the Russian forces definitely have the upper hand. But at the same time, the Ukrainian forces are really powered by strong morale and resolve to defend the city.
What drives that strong morale and resolve? Can you give us a quick little history lesson of the last few years and why? Because this is in the eastern part, southern eastern part of the country, which is in general more pro-Russian. Why is it that in the last few years it has become so staunchly pro-Ukrainian?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I know prior to 2014, with Russia's invasion and annexation of Crimea and its incursions into eastern Ukraine and the Donbass region, eastern Ukraine was certainly much more pro-Russian, had sympathies sort of with Moscow, and didn't necessarily feel overwhelming sympathies with the Ukrainian government in Kyiv. But since those incursions, they've actually had somewhat of the opposite effect of what the Kremlin might have had hoped for, which is that since 2014, there's really been a unifying presence, an increased nationalism in Ukraine. It's served as sort of a rallying cry around support for not only the government in Kyiv, but also for Ukraine's accession to Western institutions like NATO and the EU.
Right. And so it sees itself as firmly part of Ukraine now, and Vladimir Putin sees it as exhibit A for what he calls the neo-Nazification of Ukraine. Why does he call the Ukrainians in Mariupol neo-Nazis?
That's a great question. Part of the reason I would imagine, and you know, before I should address the fact that, you know, a lot of that is almost entirely propagandistic and posturing. We know for a fact that while there are, you know, some minor populations of neo-Nazi sympathizers in Ukraine, that is absolutely not the overwhelming majority of either Ukrainian army or the Ukrainian public. Or the Ukrainian government, for that matter. But at least in Mariupol in particular, that is sort of the seat of the Azov Battalion, which is the battalion that from 2014 has been fighting on behalf of the Ukrainian side, but that has some problematic history with some ties to neo-Nazi sympathies. So I think that that actually helps validate some of the Kremlin rhetoric and propaganda coming out about that region.
Mm. Right. So this battalion, this Azov battalion, has been fighting separatists, right? People who wanted to join, form a separate part of Ukraine that was more pro-Russia. And I guess this battalion had been operating outside the regular Ukrainian military?
Yes, I absolutely. And while there were certainly separatist elements that they were fighting, there's a lot of suspicions that those separatist, quote unquote, Ukrainians were actually being fomented by the Kremlin. So just to clear that up. Yeah, absolutely. They've been fighting there since 2014, but actually the Ukrainian government, Ukrainian military has taken some steps to bring them more formally into the structure of the Ukrainian military, recognizing that there were some problematic elements within those battalions.
And besides this neo-Nazi idea that Putin has floated, Mariupol is important strategically, right? Because it connects Russia to the Crimean Peninsula.
Yeah, absolutely. Geographically, it's really important. It's Ukraine's big port on the Sea of Azov, and it's important because it has pretty deep berths compared to a lot of the other ports in the region that Russia has access to. So that's really important for export and import. It's also a major industrial center, particularly with steel and iron production. But again, geographically, as you mentioned, it sits very close to the Russian border, and it's sort of a major hub in the way of Russian forces being able to use sort of the land bridge, as people have called it, to Crimea and perhaps even beyond. And so it'd be a lot easier for Russian forces to move troops and equipment and supplies across that than it would the existing bridge that they've got over the Sea of Azov.
So if Russia does manage to capture Mariupol, what does it mean for the people who are in the city still, who haven't been able to leave?
I think it's still pretty dark days for the population there. I think in some ways it might be an improvement in that they'll have access to electricity and sanitation services and food and water. But on the sort of more grim side of things, it seems like those folks could potentially be taken to resettlement camps in Russia. The young men and others could be checked for signs of sympathies or even fighting on behalf of the Ukrainian side. So things like looking for bruises on shoulders, sort of as a sign that, that those folks have been using rifles, or going through personal cell phones, looking for evidence of any kind of sympathies for Ukrainian nationalism and resistance. So it might not necessarily mean, even if the city is quote unquote, liberated by Russian forces, that those futures are any less bleak.
Do you expect that to be the case, or would there be any possible scenario where Russia does not take Mariupol?
I think at this point, it seems relatively likely. I think that even the Ukrainian government has sort of acknowledged that, even though they don't want to, say it outright. But who knows? All of us have been very wrong about how this war has progressed in general, and so it's hard to say how it's going to go.
Well, Alyssa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
That's Alyssa Demus, International Defense Researcher at the RAND Corporation. Coming up, why the California State Bar did not discipline celebrity lawyer Tom Girardi despite stunning evidence of misconduct. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Tom Girardi was once a hotshot lawyer here in LA who won millions for his clients by suing corporations accused of malfeasance. He also donated millions to political and charitable causes. He's probably best known as the now ex-husband of Real Housewives star Erica Jane. Girardi had a spectacular public fall from grace last year. He was accused of stealing millions from his clients. But despite being sued more than 100 times by some of those clients, Girardi's legal standing remained unblemished, thanks to the California Bar Association, which declined to discipline him over years. After an LA Times investigation detailed Girardi's cozy relationship with some members of the bar, including hosting them on lavish Las Vegas trips, state lawmakers ordered an audit of the state bar. And the findings were just released. They're pretty damning. We're going to talk about this now with Jessica Levinson. She's a professor at Loyola Law School and a regular legal here on Press Play. Hi.
Hi.
Well, what are the headlines from this audit? What did it say?
So the headlines from the audit are that there was huge breakdowns in the process here, that there were huge problems with the investigations, that there were problems with the punishments when punishments were given, that they were typically given privately, and that that doesn't really deter behavior, that you really need to give some punishments, some admonishments publicly, and that there's a problem with the people doing the investigation and giving the punishments, or at least some of them, in the sense that there weren't really effective regulations governing conflicts of interest between the attorneys and those who are overseeing the attorneys. So really, top to bottom, it shows looking into the problems there were issues, and then trying to rectify the problems. And then the people doing all this were, as you said, there were some cozy relationships. So it really was stunning.
So it wasn't just Tom Girardi that they were looking at in this audit. They were looking at the entire process.
Yeah, absolutely. And they named in the audit a number of other attorneys where they called out, this shows that there's really an example here. It's not just Tom Girardi. And I think it's really important that you mention that it's a systemic problem, and that he may be, in some cases, you always need like a poster boy, for lack of a better term of describing it, to maybe unravel what's really happening. But there were other attorneys where they had dozens of complaints against them, complaints that were escalating. And it really detailed that the investigations were lacking, and that the investigators didn't really adequately tie together that there was one person or two people or a few attorneys facing really numerous allegations, that they weren't providing justifications that would kind of exonerate them of wrongdoing. And then if anything, maybe slapping them on not a wrist, but maybe a finger. So yes, it went far beyond Girardi.
And did it go into details such as the ones that I mentioned above about perhaps a pay to play scenario in which these trips and other kinds of, lavish inducements were bestowed upon some of the members in exchange for perhaps looking the other way?
So it didn't go into details in the sense of naming attorneys and naming investigators. It was listed as, you know, attorney number one or this particular attorney. I mean, for me, some of the details that were maybe the most stunning were there was one attorney who received 165 complaints over 7 years, most of them either just dismissed outright or closed after a private letter, again, not a public letter. The complaints against this attorney only increased over time. I suspect that with respect to that cozy relationship that you asked me about, that falls more under the rubric of the, frankly, Tom Girardi's of the world, where they have the means to provide that kind of huge quid pro quo or appearance of a quid pro quo at the very least at this point.
So how does something like this happen? Does this mean that the entire bar needs to be revisited and cleaned out and an entire new set of rules implemented? How did this happen in the first place?
So maybe, I mean, it happens with years of neglect. It's like the car doesn't suddenly stop running. You didn't change the oil. You didn't put the right gas in. So it's years of being underfunded, understaffed. And I don't want this to read as if I'm saying there are no good people who work for the state bar. There are absolutely people who I think are just trying to go to work and dig themselves out of an insurmountable hole on a daily basis. And I don't want this audit that calls out a few bad actors and systemic problems to indicate that there's nobody there who's trying to do their job, which is to protect us from unscrupulous or incompetent attorneys. And what the recommendations indicate is that you know, this is not particularly popular all the time, but more funding, more staff, not just one-time funding, but really a revamp of how many people can work on these cases. And again, looking at more conflict of interest codes, but that would go a long way. I don't know that there's the political will to put that much new resources into the state bar.
And again, that matters because at least when we look at the case of Tom Girardi, after he was not disciplined or you know, the public was not warned, he allegedly went on to fleece many more clients who then went on to sue him.
It matters for every single client who doesn't get what they deserve, which is a lawyer who is serving them, not themselves, who is providing them vigorous representation. It matters for all of the people who were entitled to money. It matters for the future victims because this wasn't stopped immediately, that the rot was allowed to continue. And it matters because, let's be honest, lawyers don't need a worse rap oftentimes than they already have. And people, and I do take this seriously as a law professor, people really do need to have faith in attorneys. There's a reason we have ethical lawyering classes. There's a reason we all have to pass a moral character exam. Most other professions, you don't have those requirements because we do have a position of trust in society and we do have power as a result of that trust. And when you see that it's abused and you see the watchdog isn't functioning, it really is a problem.
Okay, let's switch gears for just a minute. I want to ask you about something that happened today. A federal judge in Florida threw out the federal government's mask mandate for public transportation. So that includes airplanes. That was supposed to expire today, but the CDC extended it so it could study the Omicron variant. It extended it until May 3rd. So what did the judge say?
So the judge said here that the extension of the mask mandate failed for two reasons. And the first is she said the CDC went outside of their statutory authority, that their authority is actually fairly narrow and that it doesn't include mask mandates. The other reason that she said it failed is that she said that the CDC basically suspended regular notice and comment period and they didn't have a good enough reason to suspend that, that they needed to wait, they needed to hear from the public. Very lengthy decision. I have to say to you, based on a first glance, to me, it reads as a bit of a tortured interpretation of the statutes at issue here.
And so that, are you saying that she wanted to find a way to get rid of the mask mandate?
So I will say that if I, as a judge, were faced with this language and language that I think provides broad authority, and if I were faced with a deadly virus and a mitigation strategy that we know works, which is masks, I would not choose to, I think, unnecessarily read the statute this narrowly. Mm-hmm. I did a little trust exercise with myself. I read the opinion and then I looked at who the judge was because I always try and check myself on any bias. And I did not agree with the opinion before I saw that this is a judge who was rated not qualified by the American Bar Association. She was a lame duck session appointee during the end of the Trump administration.
Jessica Levinson, Loyola Law School professor and a regular legal here on Press Play. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, an author who researches the hidden history of Los Angeles.
LA will never present its best and most interesting mysteries to you. It will force you to pick the lock to get to the good stuff.
That conversation is next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you go to 7417 Hollywood Boulevard, you'll see nothing remarkable. It's a beige fourplex with a gray awning. But my next guest has made it remarkable. He discovered that about 100 years ago, a man named Cairo lived at that address. Cairo claimed to be a world-renowned palm reader who told the fortunes of Tsar Nicholas and Rasputin, Mark Twain and Thomas Edison, before he moved to Los Angeles in 1927. But then, well, his soothsaying career fizzled. Sam Sweet writes about Cairo and others whose stories tell the history of our city across four volumes of his series All Night Menu. Each slim book is filled with essays that explore the history of a particular address. It's got photos, old ads, flyers, all to illustrate how Los Angeles keeps changing. Sam Sweet, welcome to Press Play.
Thanks for having me, Madeline.
Great to have you. So what happened to Cairo?
Cairo is an example of someone who came to LA at the very end of his life. You know, after he had sort of been run out of London and Paris and New York, he came here with great hopes, like so many people. He thought he'd break into the film business. But after the Depression hit in 1929, he was scrounging to make money. And that's actually why he turned to publishing. He started pumping out these volumes of on palmistry and occultism, and he would sell them at places like the May Company department store in the afternoon. So you could go down there and buy a book and meet Cairo. And this is someone who only 20 years earlier had been telling fortunes for the great kings and queens of Europe.
And how did you find out about Cairo, and where did you get this information about his background?
Well, for All Night Menu, I've always sort of had these topics, like a long sort of morphing list of topics having to do with LA that I always want to investigate, whether it's handball or pinstriping or surfing. And palm reading was always on that list because it always seemed like an essential part of the LA landscape to me, but not something that had ever been kind of examined through a specific story. So in looking for an inroad into palm reading culture in LA, I came across Cairo, and I liked the fact that he was an example of a character who had only spent this sort of fraction of his life here. And it was, in fact, the very end of his life, which is sort of the inverse of the way a lot of people come to LA to start their careers. And very early in that process, I was want to know exactly where people lived. It helps focus the stories. And so when I found out that he had that house on sort of the western side of Hollywood Boulevard right near Runyon Canyon, the story started coming into focus.
But he tells these stories about himself, that he read the palms of kings and queens and czars and czarinas and whoever else, right? And he sounds a little bit like a fabulist, but does that matter?
He was a fabulist. And I do think that matters, but I think it's important to understand that in that line of work, one's ability to sort of spin a yarn is actually not extraneous to the job, but essential to the job. Mm-hmm. And I'm less interested in determining whether or not exactly everything he said about himself is true than I am about what the story he told says about who he was and what his line of work was.
Right. So you are interested in these topics, as you say. So you're interested in palm reading, and then you find this character, and then you talk about the address to kind of place this character in a particular time and space. But each of the books starts out with an explanation of LA's numbering system, street numbering system. And so, first of all, explain that street numbering system. And then tell us why this framework is important for you in terms of organizing these stories.
Sure. I love the poetry and symbolism of addresses. They work the same wherever you are in a city, whether you're in a rural area or a populated area or an iconic place or a completely unknown place. So my favorite thing to do is to locate these specific addresses and then follow the way different characters and trends and types of stories move in and out, and often in completely invisible ways. The numbering system in LA originates in the 1920s. City Hall is sort of the epicenter of that numbering system. So the numbers go up from there. But of course, LA is made up of dozens and dozens of these municipalities, each of which has its own numbering system. So that both works with and collides with LA City's numbering system. Mm-hmm. But for me, these stories never begin with the address. The address is just always a way to make the history and the stories tangible.
We think of Los Angeles, it's always reinventing itself, like many great cities, New York, of course. But Los Angeles has a particular habit of erasing whole neighborhoods and rebuilding them into something else. I'm thinking of Dodger Stadium, for example, Bunker Hill, another example. Union Station was, there was a thriving neighborhood there that was bulldozed. You tell the story of one address that has the history imprinted on it of the Japanese American internment. And this is 1056 North DeGarmo in City Terrace. A woman named Molly Oyama, she went by Molly, her name was Mary, lived there. She was an advice columnist and she was pretty well connected in the city, knew lots of people, and yet she and her family were shipped off to the camps. What happened to her house after that?
Yeah, this is sort of an incredible confluence of two strands of LA culture converging in this one location. So 1056 North DeGarmo is this little house on one of the highest hills in East LA in City Terrace. It overlooks all of East LA and almost the entire LA basin. And she bought it just 6 months before Pearl Harbor. And being a Japanese American activist already throughout the 30s and someone who's really concerned with issues of assimilation and American identity versus traditional Japanese identity, Molly Oyama knew instantly that there was going to be serious repercussions for the Japanese American community in LA. So these orders slowly spread northward through the city, from the South Bay to Chinatown. And then finally, in the spring of 1942, the notice was issued for all of East LA, and that included the house on North DeGarmo. And one of the only ways you could sort of preserve your property in that situation was to find a renter who could stay in your house once you report to Santa Anita under these evacuation orders. And that climate was almost impossible for anyone to find a sympathetic renter in this sort of really toxic, hysterical war moment. But Molly Oyama was extremely connected. And so she found a young African-American couple to move in a brief amount of time. And that couple happened to be Chester and Jean Himes, Chester Himes being a former convict, an aspiring writer from Cleveland who had just arrived in LA and would later end up becoming one of the most important writers in American history and certainly one of the most important Black writers in American history.
And she knew him and was friends with him?
She did know him, although in these stories, there's always threads that you can't fully answer. And I could never determine exactly how she and Chester Himes knew each other, only to confirm that they certainly had mutual friends. There was a whole community of leftist writers based on the West Coast at that time. A lot of them wrote for the same publications. A lot of them were sort of involved in similar multiracial arts organizations. And I never found out if she knew Chester directly. I always assumed it was more likely that they had mutual friends and she put out the word. And for the Himeses, this was an incredible opportunity because they were living in a cramped apartment in South Central LA. There were new transplants to the area. And all of a sudden they had a house to themselves. One of my favorite images from that story is Chester Himes in Mary Oyama's garden overlooking the entire city, looking down into East LA and almost dazed as he tries to sort of catch up with these massive changes that are happening in LA and the world at that moment.
Pretty incredible story that this house housed two examples or two illustrations, I should say, of major historical events in our country, the internment and also the systemic racism against Black men and the Black literary scene in that time. You think of other writers of that era, Langston Hughes, for example, of the resistance among some Black artists to that, and that this house embodied both of these people who tell this larger story. It's a great story.
Yeah, completely invisible too. I mean, it's hard to believe something that extraordinary could be sort of invisible, but that was the case.
So I guess I'm wondering, how did you know that? Like, how did you attack this particular story and then find these two remarkable characters joined by this house?
Well, again, Chester Himes' time in LA is not an obscure story.
Right.
But I'm always interested in knowing about those physical spaces that people interacted with. And I'm always amazed the degree to which understanding those specific physical spaces can unlock new truths about someone's life. So at some point I returned to Chester Himes' story and wanted to understand exactly where he lived when he was here. And that's information that's very easily found now. You can go look at old census records and voter records and draft registration records in addition to his letters. And, you know, 1056 North DeGarmo was mentioned in passing in books about Chester Himes, but it was never really understood from the LA perspective, which to me is, this is a cottage on top of the hill in City Terrace. It's actually a very majestic part of the city and a really special neighborhood with its own set of meanings. So immediately when you can sort of contextualize Chester Himes in that specific house, it's no longer a footnote to his life, but a location that can completely change your understanding of him. And that story would have been interesting enough for me to pursue. The fact that it belonged to Mary Oyama and that Chester Himes acquired it precisely because of the evacuation orders was all completely coincidental. It's not something I was looking for or expecting to find. But again, I think for me, when you can sort of use these specific locations as portals, and rather than treating them as footnotes, when you go close, they open up and all this stuff starts flowing through. And that was the case in this example. I mean, like you say, it's a really extraordinary, iconic story that had been mentioned as a footnote in certain places, but not made the centerpiece of a story about either of these people. LA will never present its best and most interesting mysteries to you. It will force you to pick the lock to get to the good stuff. But I've always enjoyed that aspect of the city. And, you know, most of what makes LA really special and compelling is invisible. But that's part of what makes it so rewarding and special, that it rewards the closer look. And it rewards those who sort of initiate the curiosity and initiate the questions.
You're not from Los Angeles. You're from Maine, as I understand, correct?
I grew up in Maine, yeah.
And so do you think you have kind of an outsider perspective that allows you a different vantage point into these stories?
I do think there's something to that. I actually think that people who were born in a place can see truths that outsiders will never apprehend. And I also think that transplants to a place can see things that people who were born there won't be able to comprehend. So I do think that where I come from is sort of somehow intrinsic to my experience at LA, because it's so diametrically opposed from the landscape and the culture I grew up in. So therefore, things that I think would seem benign to a native seems sort of fresh and interesting and curious to me.
Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Thank you for coming on today.
Thanks for having me, Madeline. It's nice talking to you.
Sam Sweet, he's the author of All Night Menu. And you can learn more about this series on Sam's website, allnight-menu.com. Coming up, we meet the Ukrainian band Daka Braka. They are fighting for their country while on tour. That conversation next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Ukrainian band Daka Braka started this year with a tour through Europe. It was their comeback tour after the long pandemic. And just as they began the leg in their home country, in Ukraine, Russia invaded. The band had to cancel their shows, and like millions of Ukrainians, the members of the band fled the violence. They left behind their homes, their families, and life as they knew it. Now they're sharing their story here as they tour the United States.
Face vacant leaves, thy mind's imprint will bear. And though this book, this lonely maze thou days.
That's Daka Braka's song, Sonnet. Their music is rooted in Ukrainian folk, but includes elements of hip-hop, punk, even African and Asian beats. They describe their sound as ethno-chaos. And joining me now is one of the band members, Marko Halinievich, and the band's manager, Irina Gorban. And she'll also be translating. Welcome to both of you, Marko and Irina.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, hello.
All right. So, Marko, let's begin with you. I understand that you still have family in the country. And can you just tell us what the situation is for your family right now, where they are and how they're doing?
Марко, ми розуміємо, що ваша родина зараз в Україні. І як ви почуваєтесь з цього приводу? І як ви з ними зв'язуєтесь?
Так, моя родина...
So part of my family is not in Ukraine because my wife and my little daughter is in France because she is also an artist, and my older daughter is with me in US. But my parents and my brother and parents of my wife, they are in Ukraine, and of course we are in a constant connection and just worry about them all the time.
Переживаємо за них, звичайно.
And what about for you, Irina? The same?
My daughter and my mother are in Poland now, but my husband and my father is in Kyiv.
Oh, wow. And can they not get out, Irina? Do they not want to leave?
They don't want to leave Kyiv. And now, you know, like according to law, men in Ukraine, they can't leave the borders of Ukraine. That's why they can move only somewhere in Ukraine, and they decided to stay in Kyiv because it's their city and they want to be at homes and to defend and to help. So of course they are mostly volunteers or just sitting at home, not doing like some big and brave things like a lot of people do, but for them it's also positions to be in their city and not to leave it.
Yeah, right. So the Ukrainians are forbidding able-bodied men of a certain age to leave, that they need to stay and fight.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
So, Marko, what about you? How were you able to leave the country if Ukraine is not allowing men to leave?
So, when we understand that war will not finish very fast, our director, Vlad Troitsky, proposed us to do things that we do the best, to do our music, to play concert, to give interviews and to spread news about our war and to, of course, to raise money. So we apply for a Ministry of Culture of Ukraine to get this permit to cross the border. It was not easy to cross the border, but we did it. We just decided that it may be useful for country. But of course, this choice, it wasn't easy because, you know, like most of your friends and colleagues, they stay in Ukraine and they defend their country. But still, it's not easy for everybody. Doesn't matter your girl or man, because nobody wants to leave their countries, of course. So that's why it's still, you know, like complex of different reasons, and you think about this all the time, but we're really happy that our audience and our colleagues, like, they really support us and say that we're doing really right and correct things, and just not we are feeling guilty that we are a part of Ukraine now.
And you have been speaking out against Russia a lot way before this war began in your music and in your performances, but how has that changed since the invasion?
So it's true that for us, war started like 8 years ago, and after each performance, they tried to tell some important notice, but now it became more atmosphere, more dramatic and more thematic. And we use video now. It's also illustrations of our Ukrainian artists, some photographers, and they all devoted to war, of course.
Well, let's play a song that I think illustrates what you're talking about. This song translates to "A boat is sailing," and you've been playing this on this current tour, and here's a bit from "A Boat is Sailing." What's happening in this song? What are you singing?
So there are a lot of songs like this in Ukrainian folklore. It's pity because it's about a couple who need to be departed because the guy goes to war because he just became a soldier and goes to defend his land. And we devoted it to all people who stand with Ukraine, and we just really want to show this brave spirit in this song.
And what's been the reaction here as you tour the United States? The American public is firmly behind Ukraine in this conflict. So are you getting a lot of support from the audiences?
You know, American audience is always special for us because it's our 18th tour in US, and always really have great exception here. And, you know, we have this strange feeling that people can understand the words. We know that it doesn't, but they can feel the emotions, and we really feel this solidarity and support from US audience. It's really unbelievable. After each concert, we have, you know, these moving moments that people gave us some presents, some portraits of Zelensky, some yellow blue toys, just pictures, our portraits, flowers, of course. And it's very like important for us because we see and we feel this support from the people, and really want to thank you to the whole US people who just have this solidarity with us.
Well, let's play some more music, and here's a bit from your song called "Spring." Okay, so that's you, Marka, there with three other women on stage, and they're wearing really incredible costumes normally with headdresses, and it's really a beautiful visual sight. Tell us what you all are singing in that song, Spring.
Окей. Це пісня називається «Весна», англійською «Spring». Це
So this song called Spring, Vesna in Ukrainian, and we have in our tradition these spring songs because our ancestors there believed that it's necessary to call for spring, for light, for warmth, and change the winter. And this song is like from pre-Christianic times, so it's 1,000 years old, and it's filled with the energy of generations, and that's why it's important for us to play it, because for us it's like symbol of rebuilding of something new, and it's like ray of hope and belief in our victory, because we are sure and we're confident about our victory. But for this, of course, we need the whole world, and we really need help, because Ukrainian people are real heroes, but we really need help to defend our country. We need arms, and this is necessary to explain local governments and to people who can influence these decisions, because we really need help. It's not only about Ukraine, it's the, I think, now the world problem, and this is why it's not only against Ukraine, it's the against all humanity. So that's why we really need help, because if Ukraine disappear, Russia never stops and go further. That's why it's important to stop it now, and we're really ready to struggle till the end.
And
what about you two? When this tour is over, will you go back to Ukraine? If there's still fighting going on, there's still war, will you go back? And then what will you do?
So,
of course, in the ideal world, and we dream, we all dream about this after this tour to back home with our families, but we understand that it's really low chances to do this, but some of us, of course, go to Ukraine just to meet their families. We have really small break, only 1 week before our European tour will continue, because now it's very important for us to play a lot, because Ukraine can disappear from the newspaper, and you know, it's our possibility to remind people about Ukraine. And of course, we need to raise money not only for people who are in Ukraine, but also for refugees, for rebuilding country, because now, of course, it's a great economical and humanitarian crisis in Ukraine, and we need to support as much as we can all the people in Ukraine and outside of Ukraine also. That's why it's, of course, a complicated question, but by now we try to work as more as it's possible, because it's the only chance for us to help our country.
Do you give some of the money that you make on tour and by selling albums, do you give that money to the war effort, to supporting Ukrainians?
So part of our money, part of our fee, we just spread to different foundations. Also, 100% of sailing merch we also give to Ukraine. And we're really happy that some of the promoters also, they gave all their money for tickets to different foundations, and they have our advices where to spread it. So people who trust us personally and believe us, so they just donate money for our name, and we spread this money to different organizations and different people whom we know personally or with whom we worked last 8 years. So we help as much as we can.
Well, thank you so much for everything that you're doing, and thank you for coming on the show today to talk about all of this, and best of luck on your tour. And I hope that the conflict ends soon and that you can go back to your country and rebuild.
Thank you very much for this possibility to speak more about why in our country. Peace to all, and see you on our concerts.
Okay, excellent. And you can see Daka Braca this Sunday here in Los Angeles at the theater at the Ace Hotel. Daka Braca, which means give take in old Ukrainian. And we're speaking with the musician Marko Halonievich and band manager Arina Gorban. Baby. Shall we allow? And that's it for us today on Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.